Hey everybody, real quick up top, Mark Evan Jackson talks about his charity in Detroit called the Detroit Creativity Project. If you would like to learn more about it, go to the DetroitCreativityProject.org. And if you're interested in supporting Simon Cornell's Magic Puzzle Company, you can check that out on Kickstarter. Both of these links will be in the show notes. And one more thing, if you would like to become a monthly subscriber to the show, support it on our Patreon. You can check that out at twomagiciansonemic.com. Enjoy this episode with Mark Evan Jackson.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Mark, thanks for joining
us. Yeah, thanks, pal. How have you been in the land of quarantine?
You know, the on-camera world has shut down completely. And for the foreseeable, it's going to be interesting to see what when and how. There are some Australian models. There's a show called Neighbours that's tooling up some protocols that it's going to be very interesting. They're working in teams and such. But I'm able to record from home, which is nice. I have all the requisite tools for high quality audio over the internet. And so I've been able to do some voices. I do a handful of voices on American Dad and various things, television commercials, radio commercials, that sort of thing. So, but I mean, it's nothing compared to where, you know, what life used to be like, kind of thing. But I'm also the president and co-founder of a charity in Detroit that teaches improv in public schools. And,
cool.
And so we've been spending a lot of time doing things exactly like this, moving our curriculum online to be able to share with our students who have internet access. We've done some explainer and example videos. We've done some, you know, improv classes online. And for those that don't, and sadly there's a significant swath of the population we serve that don't have broadband, we've launched a postcard series as well.
Oh, neat.
Improv principles and suggested games and challenges to, you know, if you do have a phone or whatever, to shoot yourselves doing it and to tag us on Instagram or YouTube.
What is the name of that? That sounds absolutely fantastic.
It's the Detroit Creativity Project, and our flagship program, the Improv Project. We teach improv free of charge in middle and high schools in Detroit.
It's amazing. It's funny. We've never met before. Nice to meet you. But Nick sort of mentioned the backgrounds in improv and an interest in magic. I was just on a call yesterday with the Magic Castle Juniors program. They're still doing virtual sessions. They asked myself and a friend to do a session with them. And when asked about what sort of the number one advice, for me, it was always try and study improv. It's one of the most valuable things I've ever done as a human being. So it's fascinating to hear that it's like, there's people out there agreeing and teaching in high schools and so on.
Well, it's, for anything, whether you have a hope of being a performer or a writer or a creator of any sort, everyone should improvise. You know, if it is your lifelong goal to be an astronaut or to run a bank or to be a stay-at-home parent or what have you, like, it's the life skills taught by improvisation are so gigantic and overarching. It's enormously positive. You know, you've got to get on board and agree and collaborate. You've got to listen and react and be a part of it. And it's just so confidence building and inspiring. Mm. My wife and I were just talking this morning, in fact, about this is years ago now. We did a show at the Detroit Institute of Arts in their big Detroit Film Theater fundraiser. And Tim Meadows was back home with us, and Keegan-Michael Key was back with us. Keegan and I were in the cast of the Second City Detroit together years ago. And we were doing this show. The Detroit Institute of Arts is a world-class art museum. And we got to walk around on private tours before the show with some of our students, a group of high school students and a group of middle school students. And it was very fun and amazing to see completely unprompted and independent of one another, Keegan-Michael Key and Tim Meadows say to these kids, "How old are you guys?" And they were like, "Well, we're 17, we're 15, we're 14, we're 12. And have both Keegan and Meadows go, "Wow, I didn't start improvising until I was 25. You guys have a giant head start on me." Wow. And see those kids go, "I have a head start on these guys I see on screens. Like, wow, what could that mean?" Mm-hmm. That could mean something great, you know?
That's really cool.
Where did the idea for the DCP come from?
We a couple of mayors ago, at least one mayor ago, Mayor Dave Bing was, you know, a real champion for Detroit. And everybody that he met, wherever he was, he said, come to Detroit. If you're from Detroit, move back to Detroit. Good things are happening in Detroit. And when I lived in Detroit between 1997 and the very beginning of 2001, it was perennially 5 to 10 years away from being very cool.
Yeah, I was there at that time too. Yeah, it was. Yeah, you like going downtown wasn't really a thing other than to see, you know, a hockey game.
Yeah, but everybody's like, you know, you could feel the spirit of like, there's something here. There's a life force here. I'm not from Detroit. I lived there in my late 20s, and but in that short time, in that 3 or 4 years, it became home. Like it's a special place. There's a vibe there for sure. So Mayor Bing at the time was asking everybody to, you know, do something in Detroit, open a business in Detroit, come home to Detroit, visit Detroit. And the reason I'm talking to you today is because of improvisation. I've never studied acting. I've never taken an acting class. It's all just time on task. It's all just reps. And a lot of us are out here. There are, I know hundreds of Detroit expatriates that live in Los Angeles and New York and Chicago and everywhere that are doing the work, that are writers and actors and directors and musicians, production people. And it's all because of the attitudes we learned and the habits we fostered while at the Second City in Detroit. The common denominator of which was improvisation, saying yes, being a part of it, adding to it. Being positive, you know, eschewing fear and saying like, I don't know, this will probably suck, but let's try. and the next time it'll suck slightly less. And you realize that when you collaborate, when you walk off the back line into a white room with nothing in it, but you have everyone behind you has your back, like you can achieve the impossible. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I had a couple of, it's always referred to because, you know, Michigan is the Midwest. Whenever the Michigan papers write about it, they refer to them as cookouts. We had dinner parties at our house and had all of, you know, a few different groups of our Detroit friends over and said, what should we be doing to give back to Detroit? You know, the city that is so foundational for each of us. And I mean, inside 2 minutes, it was like, oh, we should be, you know, teaching improv to people younger than we, people that can use it, people who, you know, are overwhelmingly the Detroit schools, especially at the time, were at risk of closing, of, you know, the graduation rates were very low and the city was going bankrupt at the time in 2011. And so it became very clear that this is something that was so meaningful to us that you know, offered us this new mindset and new pathway, and we should be sharing it. So not long after that, we formed the Detroit Creativity Project, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation to be doing exactly this. And, you know, all these years later, we've got empirical scientific data from a researcher at the University of Michigan showing that not only is this super fun and, you know, confidence building and all this stuff, after a 3-year study, our students self-identified after 10 weeks of 1 hour per week of this brand of mindset, a 40% reduction in social phobia, social anxiety, and depression. Wow. So not only have, you know, attendance rates improved and test scores improved, reading scores improved, but like it's not just fun and great. Like it's has a foundational psychological wonderful impact.
Mm-hmm. And Detroit's such a great go for it, Simon, go for it.
Oh, I was going to say, as someone who only really got into improv as an adult, probably in his early 20s, I find that completely believable. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Sure.
That kind of mirrors the effect it had on my life.
I you know, I tell everybody that you know me from stuff that's more public figure stuff, more television and film stuff, like I was a wallflower. I was a C-minus student wallflower, late bloomer. Like, you know, I still get Facebook messages from people from high school that are like, you're not the guy I went to high school with, are you? Like, are you the guy I went to high school with? Because, you know, I was quiet and I was shy. And I think in my own head, I was probably, you know, sarcastic and snarky and, you know, whispering it to myself, if anyone. But like, it's entirely likely that and forgivable if people don't remember me from that time in my life. And you know, which is fine as well, like to be shy and to be an introvert. I remain an introvert to this day, I think. But it's it's such a wonderful life skill. Everyone should do it. Take an improv class, and if anybody would like to check out the very basics of it, like some just, you know, very early rudiments, they can go to dcpimprov.org or detroitcreativityproject.org and check out our videos. We, as soon as we started making them, we were like, why would we just send these to our students? This is for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, you said you're teaching classes online. You've got this postcard project. Mm-hmm. Are there any variants on that you know of that work for any ages or locations out there right now?
I mean, there's no reason that it wouldn't be terribly universal. You know, these are things that with the exception possibly of some of the environment and object work, things you could do over the telephone even, you know, like it can be audio only kind of thing. But it's... No, in fact, when we, you know, started printing the postcards, we were like, why don't we print tons more than we have addresses for just our students? And we can, you know, buy zip codes and send them to the entire, you know, entire neighborhoods kind of thing. No, it's improv is universal. You know, the goals of what a scene might look like and the level of reference for a suggestion might change if you're doing it with... you know, kindergarten age kids or high school age kids or in a corporate setting. Improv is taught in corporate settings on the regular because those places are, you know, straight fear factories that are, everybody's trying not to get fired. And so to achieve innovation and collaboration and, you know, cross location or even cross department interface, like we are not your enemy. You are the green Voltron. We are the red Voltron. Like, let's work together.
I liked what you said about introversion. We were talking, Simon and I were talking about, I think in the last episode, maybe we're both, the sad thing I think for people like us is like being told that we get to stay in our house and just like work on our own projects during this period is actually kind of like a secret good thing for guys like us, because I was the same way too, of, you know, being a performer, but at the same time, not being the class clown and not drawing attention to myself in public. So that was what was such a revelation in studying improv, that, you know, you're able to kind of express this different part of your brain and, you know, just kind of react to one another. It's just, it's a wonderful thing.
I think it's fascinating when you realize that we're improvising now. There's no script for what we're doing. When you, with Hope wearing a mask, you know, go to the grocery store and interface with other shoppers or the checkout person, life is improvised, and it's all a matter of mindset. Like, you have to decide, am I having the worst day ever? Am I having the best day ever? What shade of that in between? And as soon as you, you know, come to realize that so much of how you approach the world is a choice on your part, which character, which you are you today, things get a little bit easier, I think. Like, I think that once you realize that nobody has the answer, nobody has something wonderful right away, you know, the pressure comes off to just go, I don't know, let's see how this goes.
I just love the idea of the basic thing in improv is just reacting to what's given to you, reacting in a positive, your choice, positive or negative, ideally positive. But that is such a great thing to take into the real world, as you just mentioned, just reacting to something. You get to choose how you react to this and how it affects you. And I mean, that's like a Zen philosophy right there. It's like you get to choose what your day is like. And it's, you know, when done well, it's amazing to watch. And when applied to your actual life, it is life changing. It's pretty crazy.
It's remarkable to realize that in life, as on in an improv scene, that if you walk in with a plan, you're going to fail.
Sure.
Like if you have a soul focus already on board and you're like, I'm doing this, rather than go, let's see, I don't know, you know, I have something I want to talk about if it comes up, but like if you try to shoehorn your agenda or your ideas or and again, in life or on stage, it's going to bring the scene to a halt. It's going to bring the conversation to a halt. Life becomes a lot more interesting when you become an improviser, when you, you know, begin to listen and react, because it's world opening. Like you don't go, yeah, I don't know much about magic, so please don't tell me a single thing. You go, I don't know much about magic, tell me everything, you know, like about politics and whatever. And I grew up in a very normal home, but I think that somewhere in there it was, you know, taught like, I don't I know, I got it, thank you, good, all good here. And it's like, Oh, I think about the, you know, thousands and thousands of conversations that I'm sure just with my physical posture, I shut down rather than go, it doesn't make me dumb or weak not to know this yet. How could I? Please tell me everything. What is it like being a cook at a restaurant? What is it like being an airline pilot? What is it like being a mom? Like, you know, I don't know. It ironically, questions are frowned upon in improv because they rob the scene of energy. Typically, you're asked in a scene to emotionally give the answer that you were looking for rather than ask the question itself. Don't rely on your scene partner to write the scene for you, kind of thing. But what it spurs in real life is questions, 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 you know, like in a wonderful way, because it makes you a more curious, more interested, and therefore more interesting person, you know?
Yeah. And even in things you do know about, I mean, it's in various philosophical systems, the concept of maintaining the beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. And I apply that even to magic. That's probably the single thing I know the most about, but I approach it as permanent beginner. Like, I don't know, what I don't know is dwarfs what I do know. Let's keep discovering.
Yeah,
and I question everything.
I think it's, you know, scales and arpeggios even for master pianists, you know, like you, it's the basic, it's the rudiments. Yeah. The road to mastery is repetition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you never know when suddenly some new piece of info will upturn everything you thought you knew. And that's great and exciting. It's like, ooh, this is new.
Oh, it's scary. Like horribly frightening. You know, when we were at the Second City back in the day, every once in a while, a different sort of, you know, Second City legend performer director would come through and they'd be like, okay, we're going to do it my way. And you're like, but I'm so good at what I do. and they'd break you down and they'd show you your habits and, you know, and that's where you get strong, is where, like, if I've got this, you know, like ace in the hole accent or character or joke or whatever, like, save it for when it's absolutely called for and you will look like a superhero. Pull it out twice in a show and you look like a moron. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So save it. Expand your quiver. Have more clubs in your bag, more arrows. And you know, I'm having a sense memory right now of Michael Gelman, a director.
Oh, I had Michael Gelman as a teacher.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was. Everybody was terrified of him in Chicago. Yeah, I did this conservatory, and everybody was terrified of him. And I thought he was amazing. He was like just this guru.
OG, like friend of Del Close, a really good dude who's you know, a friend of mine to this day. But you know, he came and this is back in the day, and during notes, he'd dangle a cigarette from his lips, and he'd just go like, "You do this a lot." And it's like, like. I don't, people laugh and they're like, does it feel good though? Like, you know, are you pushing yourself? Like, I can remember a great Michael Gelman thing. My friend Mary Vanette and Keegan Michael Key, we were in a rehearsal and they were pitching a scene for a Second City review that we were all in that was about, like, it was about Detroit. It was about buying abandoned buildings and refurbishing. And it was, you know, going to be this whole scene on gentrification and what it means to, you know, what will a true Detroit Renaissance look like? And he was like, great, put it up. And we're all out in the house during the day in the theater, and Mary and Keegan get up on stage and they're, you know, waiting to, they're in an elevator, the lobby of a decrepit building, and they press the elevator button and they're waiting for the elevator and whatever. And Gelman was like, stop. Oh my God. Oh my God. And they're like, we're not even into the scene yet. He's like, I don't care. That's not how you wait for an elevator.
Yep.
Like, he's like, do it again. Lights up. And they were like, And I think Keegan, you know, they were trying to convey, like, you know, a time crunch or something. And Keegan tapped his foot and he's like, stop. Oh my God. Like, do it again. And it became, I think, like 40 minutes of him, honest to God, it was forever. It may have only been 20, but it felt like forever. And all of us in the house were like, I'm so glad it's them and not us. And he was like, just be, don't do, just be. And they were on stage and it was obviously a business relation. Like, I think Mary was playing a realtor and Keegan was an investor or something. And they press the button and the elevator doesn't come. And it's like, you just feel them both go like, don't make eye contact. Like, boy, this elevator's taking forever. I hope it works. You know, like not saying a word, not doing a thing. So it made there when they did swing to check in on each other. It made it so, like, by the end of it, we were in the house dying. Like, it was so funny and painful and protracted. And then, you know, he was like, okay, so what's your scene about? They're like, we don't care anymore. Like, we like, can we take a break? You know, like, we need to rest. But it was so meaningful just to, you know, see a true master. But he did. He would break us down. There was a game I will never forget that I hate to this day called Drop, 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 where it was a physical game, and he would just make us do something. And as soon as you recognize the pattern in something physical, you would go drop, and you have to come up with something completely new. And if you go back to something that you did that looked like jumping jacks and you'd done jumping jacks earlier, he'd say drop right away. So he might be like drop, 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 drop. And like, you'd play it for minutes and minutes. And like, at the end, you're like, my breath, like, I can't, have I ever moved before? Like, like, it was just so, you know, undoing. And it broke several of us. And, you know, Gelman's a person that always told us, like, if you submit to this program, like, if you allow improvisation to undo you and show you your habits and you allow it to peel you like an onion, those of you who are able to put yourselves back together will go on and do this forever. And those of you who can't will go do something else. And that's fine, too. You know, like, but yeah, that stuff is really, really powerful.
We had some similar to your elevator experience. I just remember we're all sitting on chairs and same thing. It went on for like 40 minutes. It's like, okay, underneath your chair is an object. Just pick it up and examine it. And we're all just like, you know, miming, doing this great physical work. And he's like, stop it, do it again. And we're all just trying to figure out. It was the same thing of like, what is he trying to get at? And eventually we all got to that point of it's not about the object. It's just about experiencing what's happening and reacting to it. And I just remember him always having an apple, rubbing it on his leg or his arm. And he's doing a lot of experiences like you just mentioned. He's a great teacher. Great teacher.
There's one last Gelman story. He, in the middle of the night, like we'd do two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. And then we would, when we were in the process of writing a new show, you'd always do an improvised set after every show. But, so we would take out scenes that we were hoping to, you know, codify into something repeatable and write into the next review. And he'd be after the show, the audience would leave, and you know he'd have a legal pad with his notes from our scenes, and he was always deep in thought. And again, this is back in the day, so he'd have a Marlboro Red hanging out of his mouth, and he'd come and he'd be like, okay, so this scene about this, and he'd have a lighter in one hand and a cigarette, and he'd go like, I don't know if it takes place at a diner, like it feels like it needs a bigger, you know, as it meant, and he wouldn't light the cigarette, and he near missed on the cigarette so many times that like it became all we could focus on, like just light the cigarette, light it, and he'd get it and go, you know what it might be, and that would happen for like an hour, no joke, and you just see like seven actors and a musical director in the back and stage manager like. Light it. Like, it was, they're days I'll never forget.
It's like that scene in The Office where they're just like watching.
I was about to say that. The DVD logo. I just had the same thought where they're like, yes. And Michael Scott's like, I guess.
That was it.
Good meeting.
Sometimes you inspire people.
Amazing. One of the big things that jumped out about me about those stories was the don't do be.
Yeah.
And I did. I had the privilege of doing a week long workshop with, do you know Avner the Eccentric? He's just amazing.
That's
performer.
A familiar name. Yeah,
he's the kind of person you've heard
he's
of.
Brilliant,
yeah,
physical comedian.
Yeah, yeah, physical comedian, sort of a clown with a capital C, you know, like in the good sense,
sure,
rather than anything. And just one of the best performers I've ever seen. And one of the things that kept coming up in his direction in the scenes and the workshops was you're indicating, like, don't show it, just to do the thing,
yeah,
experience the thing, be in that scene. Rather than trying to show the audience that you're in that scene. And I've probably got by far the least improv experience out of the three of us here, but it's something I've been just profoundly passionate about and devour any opportunity I get to get into it.
That's cool. Yeah, it's a continuum, right? Like there are no black belts. Like you don't. It's a muscle, and you can get rusty. I have a lot of famous friends that I used to do a show in Santa Monica. And it never quite achieved the goal I had in mind, but I wanted just to do like a show once a month for people from TV that have like, you know, once you're a little bit visible, you go like, oh, am I gonna like improv scenes? Improv shows can fail; they can be terrible.
Yeah.
You know, my very accomplished friends and I from time to time, like the spirit's just not with you, or you're not listening, or you're, you know, distracted or whatever. And shows, you know, with the best people in the world can from time to time fail. And so people are like, well, I've got a career now. Do I really want to go be vulnerable in front of, you know, beers fooling strangers? And worse yet, like improv devotee students. So I went at the West Side Eclectic, at the West Side Comedy Theater for a time. Tawnia Newsom and I did a show where we did invite people. But it never really achieved what I wanted it to, which was like having Ken Jeong come play and, you know, Tom Lennon come play and stuff. Like on a regular, just a safe workout room where it's going to be everybody from, you know, that have careers. And it's like, well, if we all suck, then we're fine. You know, like... Yeah. That kind of thing. You're right. It's a continuum. It's something that like you're never there, and you have to keep up. You have to practice the muscle, or you know, rehearse.
That's what is so ballsy to me about Middleditch and Schwartz out on Netflix right now. And I apologize if this is like when people ask us about David Blaine, but so we get it. But they're doing that. They're, you know, they're performing for 1,000 seat theaters, if not more.
Bigger than that, yeah.
And so to do a completely improvised show that could potentially fail is, and obviously they're amazing, and but yeah, it speaks to what you were just saying of it. There are bad improv shows. It's what happens, and it's crazy.
The those guys are friends of mine, and I think that
I watched all three of them. They're brilliant specials. I'm so glad long form has been brought to, you know, the mainstream.
God, yeah.
It's the shows are brilliant. These guys, I think one of the magic ingredients is that they're very good at it, obviously. But I think it's a fearlessness, and frankly, the audience, like I knew that they wouldn't fail because they're charming people who are kind and nice to one another, and listen and love one another, and you know, like playing together. But I wasn't sure whether the long form arc of a show, calling back characters later in a set, would work on camera. I knew that, like, you know, I do a show not dissimilar from theirs with Paul F. Tompkins, Mr. Jackson and Mr. Tompkins, and it's that show but in tuxedos, and we get one word from the audience, and you know, we start those shows by just chatting. Paul and I will, you know, we've done it in various cities across North America, and we'll go out and just talk about like some, you know, without fail, something interesting will have happened on the flight there, or a restaurant, or we went to a baseball game in Toronto and funny things happened. So we'll talk about that. The audience would love it if that's all we did, you know, like it feels like a 1200 person cocktail party kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's certainly true of Ben and Thomas. Like they could certainly just do that, but they really masterfully, you know, juggle a lot of details, and they play a lot of characters within the same scene very often.
Playing each other's characters, to me, was the biggest revelation of making sure the audience could follow. I know improvisers can follow that, but can like people who've never seen an improv show follow that? And they do, and they do it brilliantly. It's so cool.
Precisely. Yeah, they use the stage well. You've hit it on the head. That's one of the elements that I was like, you know, I've been, because audiences don't know, obviously anybody that's going to buy an expensive ticket to go see these two live probably is improv adjacent or familiar and obviously loves those two. But I have, you know, I've been doing this for 20 something years, and my brother still from time to time will go like, I wouldn't do that basketball scene again. It's like, we're not going to do any of these scenes. What are you talking about? He's like, it just wasn't funny. And it's like, yeah. No, do you know what I do? Like, do you think that we wrote this?
That's kind of the parallel between magic and improv, in that a lot of magicians watch magic and a lot of improvisers watch improv, but you forget that it's meant for normal people.
Right. Yeah.
Who don't believe, it's one of the classic parallels that in the similarity is, again, with improv, no matter how much audience input you take, people in their hindbrain still kind of feel it must have been written. There's no way it could have been that good without being written. And in magic, they never believe that there aren't plants in the audience, that you didn't have people set up in it. No matter what lengths you go to prove that, no, we really are this good. We have figured out ways to do this.
Yeah.
They just don't. Some people just won't believe it. But the I completely agree about long form improv. It's absolutely my favorite form of it. And I think one of the benefits of long form, at least studying it, is it removes the ability to get seduced by just going for the gag. Mm-hmm. You can't afford to now. You've got to work on the narrative and the character. And shout out to, Tom Selinsky and Deborah Francis White of the Spontaneity Shop in London, which is where I studied improv. And they were real just masters of long form. The first improv show I saw them do was a full long form piece, and it was just stunning. It was just one of my favorite things.
It's when it works, it's magic for sure. It seems like sorcery. Like it's like, I can remember long before I knew him, Craig Kakowski, I saw it at I.O. in Chicago when I was just beginning short form stuff in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I saw him do a Herald at Improv Olympic. And it was like, who is this time traveler? Like, who is, he's existing in dimensions I can't even fathom. It is absolute magic for sure.
It was so, to be in Chicago, like I went to college there and I did Second City there. And so like to be there, it was so wonderful to see like literally the best of the best. It's like coming to the Magic Castle. You're seeing the best magicians and there you're seeing the best improvisers, but it's also incredibly intimidating. Did you ever get in your head at all, or was it just more of an inviting experience?
No. For all the wonderful Zen tenets of improvisation, it's a blood sport, especially in a place like Chicago, where, I can remember when my contract was up in Detroit, I was interested in going to Chicago. Los Angeles seemed very far away and scary, and I remember Kelly Leonard, who was then president of Second City. I called him, and he said, he literally said, "Buddy, I don't need any more smart white guys in Chicago." And I can remember Francis Callier, who then was running Chicago from like a casting perspective, I think, for the stages. She was I'm sure these numbers have quadrupled, if not more. She was like, this was in 2000, said, I have, like 850 qualified, ready to go actor improvisers in the city of Chicago and 16 paying jobs. And it was like, those aren't great odds. So it is, people put in their hours, they lurk, they hang out at the bar, they're on the rail, they try to be in the wings, ready to go in case there's a put me in coach kind of situation. And it is a wonderfully collaborative art form, but it's also, Hollywood's the same, right? Like it's, that's why whenever I get blue about, things not being where I want them to be, like things are very good for me, but it's also, I've been here since the very beginning of 2001. Like my trajectory has been gradual.
Yeah.
I'm thankful for every bit of it. But it's equal parts, like it's about time and thank you universe,
sure,
like
it's
all of it. But whenever I get, in my head about like, I should be here, I should be doing this, it's like, you have very good friends that would cut off your arm to do one of these commercials or to do one voice on this or to, to have a small role in one of these shows that you're part of or whatever. So I think it's important to, not only be aspirational and hungry, but to be thankful and to look back and go like, okay, like it's working, do what you're doing, maintain your course. There's no measurement for that stuff either. I have friends that came out here and got famous in 2 seconds. And I have friends that I look at and go, how is this person not a household name?
Sure.
Like they're,
I know several people from Second City Chicago that have done a bunch of bit parts, but still are just, knocking on doors and auditioning like crazy. And it's the same thing too. If there is no rhyme or reason, this person is just as talented as X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, oh, because time-wise, it's all of it. But I know very talented people who've had to move home and explore other careers, and I know very famous people that are terrible.
Yeah, because being a household name is only slightly meritocratic.
Yeah.
Sadly, but that seems to be the way it is.
If I could fanboy out for a second, there is a what is it, AT&T commercial you did where you say it's happening. The way you read that line, because I've seen that commercial 1,000 times in my house, thank you very much, is just a masterclass. Is there any way you can speak on I don't know, you have A, like nailing an audition, but B, like, you, I don't know how many takes you do in a commercial like that, but it seems like you just have to kind of go with your instincts and your gut. But I don't know. It's just watching that to me is, you know, having a theater background and a performance background, I just, that one line is says so much and it's kind of profound.
Thank you. that line was improvised. I play a lot in auditions and in, when we're shooting, in most things that I do, I improvise. I get hired because I improvise.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a balance. Like, you still have to, you know, you can't just tear up the entirety of their script. But I get hired a lot because I'm able to find nuancey moments. And people that like that are people that I work with, and people that go, were you given new pages? Why are you saying these words we've never... then it's like, oh, I don't belong here. I'll see, like, have a great life. Oh, yes. You know? But yeah, that line was improvised. So that commercial, a lot of those AT&T OK, that campaign was directed by a friend of mine, Marty Granger. And he loves to play. He's from Second City, Toronto, and lives in New York now. But he's a guy that, you know, writes really good foundational structures for things. And like, what if a high level business meeting were being, you know, translated by somebody that's not good at it? And then you can play. So the line read, the delivery of it's happening. Once I mistakenly tell the Dutch dude to go hug the American dude, is just, you know, it's a shot. We often, Detroit is a hockey town. And so we often refer to shots on goal. Like, you know, you can't score unless you shoot, and your odds will go up the more shots on goal you take. So, and it's a thing, to harken back to improvisation. It's like, you know, sometimes in auditions, they'll say, like, you'll do it and you'll do the way you wanted it to be done. And they'll be like, anything else you want to try? And sometimes, depending on how I'm feeling, I'll be like, no, you saw it. Like you're laughing. You're laughing. I'm leaving. And sometimes it's like, oh, I'm bottomless. Like, we could be here till tomorrow. Like, I'm, you know, this is what I do. So very often on Parks and Recreation or Brooklyn Nine-Nine, like, you'll shoot the scene and then they'll be like, fun run? Like, something you want to try? And you're like, oh, goodness, yes. Yes, yes, yes. and less so with The Good Place, because that we did play some, but that was a little bit more buttoned up because of the nature of the show itself. But
yeah, that makes sense.
All those worlds are very playful worlds, and commercials are that way too. Done well, sometimes commercials are fear factories because they're so corporate. You've got the client of, you know, the car manufacturer or whatever, then you've got the agency that's like, we got to please the client. Mm-hmm. And then there's the production team that's like, we should go home soon. And then, you know, actors who are like, don't get fired, don't get fired. And, it's, I think that that's something that I've learned throughout the years too, that took far too long, about auditioning. Like, when you're auditioning, you're not auditioning for the role that you're there for that day. Like, you're statistically, you are not going to get that role. So be the human that says, you know, that remarks on something in the room, be the human, you know, that can interact with other people, because the least senior person in the room, the person in the corner with the clipboard or the person running the camera, is going to be a casting director in a couple of years. So make them remember you. And I don't mean, you know, fake a heart attack. I just mean, like, go be great at the way you can do it, in a Michael Gelman sense. Like, go. Gelman also told us back in the day that, like, if you go through this process well, never again will you go into a room going, what are you looking for? You'll go, watch this. Like, and if the planets align and you're doing it in a way that's meaningful to them, you're going to work for those people for the rest of your life. And if it's not, they'll go, like, that guy was weird. And 2 years later, they'll go, who was that weird guy that we saw for that thing that was, he was completely wrong for, but let's bring him in. Cause casting directors have a special brain. They have a Rolodexy brain that they remember people decades later. I've had it happen several times. And so I do think that it's important to go and, you know, do what you want to do, because you're statistically, you're not going to get that job. So I think that once I learned, like, oh, I might, you know, it's a mistake to go in going, like, this job pays $5,000. You've already failed. But if you go in going, like, I don't need this job. So I'm going to have fun and I'm going to be myself and I'm going to do with the material what I think I should do. Then they go, he doesn't need this job. We should give it to him.
That's you something know, like, I remember Gelman said. That's another Gelman quote. He's like, you will always book the job that shoots in the middle of Iowa for very little money because you don't give a crap. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but yeah. That's exactly what you're saying.
Oh, also, yeah. To be unavailable is very desirous. Like the second every time I've bought an expensive plane ticket, you know, my phone won't have rung for months. And every time I buy an expensive plane ticket, do you remember when we used to buy plane tickets?
What's a plane? Simon and I formerly did lots of cruise ships, so we are very well aware of what it's like to live on planes, and it's very strange for us not to be on planes right now.
For me as well, I fly a lot, and I like am not looking forward to going back.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to be working, but like we're going to have to get a note from mom before it's like I'm going to go sit shoulder to shoulder with, you know, someone I don't know, right?
Yeah, the thought like way in the back of our mind was maybe we'll surprise our parents for Mother's Day in Detroit, and then we're like, that's a terrible idea right now.
Yeah,
that's it's a weird time.
My question, Mark, on the previous topic was, I'm sure obviously you get a lot of people commenting on your work on Brooklyn Nine-Nine and The Good Place and everything. How often have people complimented your work on one particular line in an AT&T commercial?
Commercials are ubiquitous. It's not rare. I don't know that anybody's drilled down on my performance of an improvised line. You know, I'll walk the streets and people will shout 99 from time to time. And it's happened that I've been walking places and people go, it's happening. that has in fact happened. That's happened.
I mean, going back to the audition, like I was an intern at O'Connor Casting in Chicago for a summer or so. And yeah, just sitting in the room and watching people walk in and out, do an audition over and over was maybe like was better than 4 years of theater school, just watching, okay, that worked. That guy walked in with Crocs. That guy's wearing a weird shirt. And like, that's what people are commenting on. Like, you don't want them to remember that you're the Crocs guy. You want them to remember you did a great performance or something interesting that's memorable. So yeah, totally relate.
I wasted a lot of time, I think, not doing the work. So like, I'd be like, you know, I'd print it on the morning of, and I'd have the script next to me in the car and I'd like glance at it. And like before I'd go in, I'd go like, I'm 85% off book. And it's like, oh, you failed. Like you have to know it's so cold, you know, the words backwards and forwards so you can scream it or whisper it or, you know, shout it in a storm or do it while you're being pummeled or whatever. Like, and so I didn't, you know, I think I used to look down on commercials too, like as an art form, and they, you know, economically, they can be far more lucrative than anything than a movie role. You know, like you can, if you get a commercial or let alone a campaign that runs, like it can be really wonderful. So I used to, you know, I think go like, oh, it's just a commercial, and therefore, you know, sabotage myself by not putting in the work to like really go get it. And, you know, being off book is like the minimum that you've got to be so cold on that before you can begin to make a choice about the character or the comedy of whatever little, you know, slice of life narrative thing that's meant to be.
I think that's why that was the biggest thing. A, I wasn't booking much, but B, that's why I went into magic more full time and let go of acting is I couldn't memorize crap. Like, it's amazing how that is a skill in itself. My wife is an actress and she's amazing at memorizing things. And I'll look at something forever and just nothing. That is like skill number one that they just don't tell you at theater school. It's like, maybe you should be really good at memorizing stuff.
It's part of it. But I'll tell you, I know people all across the board, even very accomplished people that, you know, have some form of a learning disability, dyslexia, what have you. Like, there really is no excuse. Like, you do just have to run it. And if whatever mnemonic devices or what, like anything that any tricks, any visuals, any whatever, and it's still sometimes hard. I book a lot of stuff, and I think now people write for me in this direction for things that I recur on, big chunky paragraphs. Like, I'm often given, you know, rants and screeds and stuff, you know, sometimes you'll get sent the script and you're like, come on, you guys.
They probably like, what, a day or two before shooting?
Well, sometimes it's, you know, at this stage of the game, it's often before the table read or whatever. But a table read's a performance. Like you, some people cold read a table read. Kristen Bell doesn't read a script before a table read and she goes and destroys, which is a maddening thing to have happen because it's like, I was in the van with you just now. I know you haven't read this. And you just absolutely nailed the intention of that, like, you know, like perfectly in a moment, in a a live read, just did this. Whereas I will work it a lot. It was a very charming thing to learn early on. I can remember we were in our chairs, Ted Danson and I, between takes, shooting in the Bad Place Architects offices in downtown in Los Angeles at what used to be an ancient Bank of America.
That is the bad place.
And Ted was, you know, he's like, do you want to run this? And I was like, sure. And he's like, it's funny, you know, last night when Mary and I were going through this, and I was like, I'm sorry, Mary Steenburgen reads my lines with you the night before we shoot? And he's like, yeah. It's like, that's incredible. And he, you know, they both do the work. Like they both have gigantic careers. And so you know, if Ted Danson can, after dinner the night before, like spend an hour or two doing it.
There's no excuse.
I can find some time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so again, so many just raging similarities with magic there.
Yeah.
About, I mean, one is that dichotomy of what pays well versus what is creatively or artistically compelling.
Mm.
Massive dissonance between those two frequently.
Yeah.
And then the fact that, yeah, to sort of get your basics, your technique, your execution flawless is just the beginning. That's just the baseline.
That's the baseline.
That's sort of the minimum expectation. Yeah. Then you actually begin doing the real work.
Yeah, that's real.
And many people are lazy and don't. But hey. And some of them are just prodigies who don't need to. And well, what do?
That's
the
maddening.
Rest of us have to work hard.
Yeah, that's maddening. You like you will never have that. That's just not not your trajectory. So God bless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can't fly. You can't shoot lasers from your eyes. You can't just turn up with no work and nail it. Oh well.
Yeah,
there are other paths up the mountain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't want to keep you too much longer. Thanks for taking the time of doing this. We always end with like kind of like from magicians. It's usually like a horror story or something that's happened in a live performance that kind of stands out. Anything in the improv world that something chaotic that's ever happened to you?
Oh, I mean, for sure. It's improvisation. Your invoking horror story makes me think of when I was in the Second City of Detroit before I was the musical director, before I was an onstage cast member. And when I was in the touring company as the musical director for the Second City Detroit, we were at a fundraising event, a charity event. I think it was either at U of M or Michigan State. It was at one of the big theaters on one of the campuses. And, you know, we were coming to do a 50-minute probably review of sketch and song and lighthearted jokes and stuff. And the event was some like pediatric cancer charity. So we're in the green room, you know, just about to go on. And a woman says, like, before the Second City comes out, please watch this video. Okay. And it was a 12-minute montage of dead children, you know, to piano music and like a slow motion, you know, fading out montage of birth and death dates that were not terribly far apart from one another. And then she came out and she said, ladies and gentlemen, the Second City. And we had to go do a 50-minute you know, sketch at bus and truck show for people that were bawling in memory of dead children. I can remember our stage manager, Andrew Graham, was up in the booth and we were down in the green room watching this on a monitor going, are you kidding me? And then like we were really watching the video and he flew down from the booth to backstage and clicked. He was like, stop watching this. And he just clicked off all the televisions. Like, you have a job to do. You have a job to do. And we went and we did our show and it was terrible.
Can we have a suggestion? Not dead children, please.
Oh yeah. My goodness.
Wow.
Wow.
I think there is so much beauty in those stories because we're so, one of the sort of the themes that has accidentally emerged in this podcast is that there is yin and there is yang, and both are important to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And too much leaning to one. And I think in society, we have this tendency to only want to tell the turnaround success stories. And that's not what life is. Often they don't. Something, you know, because normally that would be a story where then you found a way to bring it together. And that does happen, but also sometimes it doesn't. That's okay. That's part of the journey.
It is okay.
Sometimes
there
it
is,
just tanks.
If you walk into a scene with a preconceived notion of where it's headed or what it's going to be about, you aren't listening and you are going to fail. And I feel like it's that in life too. And my journey has certainly, as I said before, been a balance, and it took a long time to realize it. And it's a mission of continuous discovery and realization to be like, there is no finish line. Like, you know, for a career in Hollywood or a life on this planet, like none of us know what our time is. None of us know the end of the story. And so be thankful, be kind, be available, say yes to stuff, scare yourself, challenge yourself. And it will result in a balance of like, thank you, God. And it's about fucking time.
Man, that's maybe the best exit we've ever had for an episode. Thanks so much, man. This was great. Thanks for taking the time.
Absolute pleasure.
Nice chatting with you. Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.